So if you haven't got enough social connection in your life, you're feeling isolated, your brain will actually crave that social connection. But what you'll find is that people that are isolated and haven't got that social connection, they'll replace that, whether it's food, whether it's drugs, because they can't identify what that craving is. They just need to meet people, talk to people, to connect with other human beings.
Welcome to part two of the Social Fabric podcast live with Dr. Brian Penny, recorded live in the Whale Theatre on the 29th of February 2024. Just before the second half, I showed a video called Nuggets, scripted, directed and animated by Andrea Zicade. It's a very powerful video and it was recommended to me by Rena Hullahan, my lecturer at the psychotherapy degree course that I'm currently doing. And I thought it was a really important video to show to start a conversation around addiction in neuroscience for the second half of the show. If you enjoy this conversation, if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, share and review. It's much appreciated and it's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. The title tune is Happy and Shining by The Roundabouters. And you can get more information and more episodes on socialfabric.ie. Thank you.
I thought this was so powerful that I wanted to show it because that's what we're going to talk about now. What is neuroscience? What is this thing?
So neuroscience is basically, it's the study of the brain and nervous system. So a lot of people think it's just the brain, but it is the nervous system. And if you think of like everything you think, feel or do, is an electrochemical signal coming from your brain or to your brain. And it's everything we think, feel and do. Like it's electrical and chemical energy firing around our body. So the neuroscience is just the study of that. But it's involved in feelings, it's involved in thinking, it's involved in behavior. And yeah, that's the essence of it.
So when you decided to, so your story now, we're done with drugs, great. We're not going back there for a moment. So you're now, your new addiction is learning. You just can't get enough of books. And you decided, right, let's do, first of all, a degree in psychology. Yep. And then a PhD on, what's the PhD on?
The PhD, it was a research PhD. So it was in the School of Psychology, but it was in the Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity College. But it was exploring this wanting more. So I was very interested in the dopamine response in terms of the reward pathways of the brain, but the emotional pathways of addiction. Like, so let's say basically speaking, it could be like negative emotions bring you to addictive tendencies. So it's Monday, you feel crap, let's have a drink. Oh, it's Friday, I feel great, let's go have a drink. And both of those emotional pathways, positive and negative emotions, can drive us in that direction. But what I found is with people in recovery and people in general, like I think so many people today, we have a hole in our soul, whether it's disconnection. I think that's a huge element of it, loneliness, disconnection. The world we live in today, we're so busy, we haven't got time for real experiences anymore. We're running around like busy bees all the time. And I just think many people are struggling with a hole in their soul, and we're filling that with phones, with food. We're trying to fill it with phones and food, materialistic pursuits, drink and drugs. And that's my research sort of explored the nature of this wanting more, this craving of wanting more. That was the nature of it.
And when we look at that cartoon, I mean, that really encapsulates what you told us, you know, and I don't know what you felt like when you were looking at that, but it's such a clever, simple cartoon of the arch that we go through when we get addicted to something and when that stops being the wonderful thing that we believe it was.
Yeah, it makes me sad actually looking at that. Like, it's a very lonely place. Addiction is a very lonely place. But I think thinking about it from a neuroscientific perspective, it's back to that trauma or back to any physical pain. Like when we are struggling with anything, there's an area of the brain. I think most people have heard sort of a common knowledge the language people use. It's called the amygdala, or it's actually the amygdala because we have two. And people often think about that as the fear response or negative emotions, but the amygdala is really just it's a meaning-making machine. So if something happens in your environment, the amygdala will fire up and it will sort of look at that and see, is it good or is it bad? The valence of it's called, is it good or is it bad? If it's bad, your brain to, from a self-preservation perspective, because all the brain, especially the older part of the brain, it wants to survive and reproduce. Our brain does not want us to be happy at all. It wants to survive and reproduce. It's about self-preservation. So if you feel pain, emotional, psychological pain or physical pain, it wants to escape that pain. The amygdala will light up and we will look to repeat that behavior if it works to escape that pain. So just like that, the little image there, like it took the little bird to heaven. And it got that high, it took it away from whatever the pain, if it was boredom or whatever was going on there. But then it just quickly takes you to hell as well. So it nearly hijacks the reward pathway. And something that my research looked into, and I like that little bird, like maybe there was no pain in his life. But if you go along and all of a sudden you start having a few drinks, you like that. You're rewarded by that. And people often think about dopamine as like this, the pleasure neurotransmitter of the brain. Dopamine is more around motivation and taking action. So if you get a dopamine hit isn't even the right language. If there's an increase of dopamine activity in the reward pathway, it will motivate you to repeat that behavior. And again, that's an evolutionary response to keep us alive. Figs in a tree, that'll keep us all alive. Let's do that more in the future. But we're fighting against evolution and a world today that's selling food, phones, drink, alcohol, all these different things. We're fighting against the corporate industry and evolution, selling us all these things, trying to get us addicted, because addiction is a very profitable game. So that's the reality of it. We're fighting against all of these massive, powerful forces. And if you're struggling with some kind of pain in your life as well, and you're escaping that pain with that, it's going to take over. It really is. And it's very hard to get away from that.
But there are a couple of things there when you're talking about the trauma and the pain. And again, I'm casting my mind back to my friends, the team. And I have a team in mind. And I remember the goalkeeper, he ended up on heroin. And I think he came out of recovery when he was 18. And I remember meeting him in the local bar, the little coffee shop that we have. And Luca was his name. I said, Luca, what's the story? And I said, I can't wait to get back on the gear, whatever the Italian word for the gear. Yeah. I was like, wow. And he was like, yeah, no, I can't wait. No, he didn't have pain, as far as I know. Now, I was quite young. So it was just the, it was just that. I want more, I want more with the habitual behavior. Yeah. So tell me more about that.
And that's, it's really interesting. That's why there's multiple pathways into addiction. That's, it's always very nuanced. So it's like if you like something, there's a liking pathway, the reward system of the brain, like it's, there's multiple different areas of that reward pathway, but there's one area called the liking system. And if you like something and you repeat that behavior, that can become a kind of a wanting, and it translates into another neural circuit in the brain, and then you want this thing. And over time, if you just repeat that behavior, it'll become a pathological craving of you trying to get that drug or that behavior or whatever it is. And I suppose on a neuroscientific level, like it's releasing dopamine and other neurotransmitters in within the neurons of the brain. When you release more dopamine within the brain, let's say if it's cocaine addiction, it will flood the brain with dopamine. The other end of the neuron, the receptor that takes in that dopamine, that will grow to realize that more dopamine is being released in that path, in that network. So that will sort of grow more receptors and crave more dopamine. So that's where tolerance kicks in. You need more of the drug to get the same hit. So you just want more and more and more. So your reward pathway has literally been hijacked. So you probably never had that initial pain, but all of a sudden your brain is screaming for this drug or this behavior because it's the only thing you can get pleasure from.
So in layman's term, that cycle you're talking about, can it be hijacked, but everything else is going on? So if I become addicted to whatever, cigarettes, it doesn't matter. So I'm creating those neural pathway. At the same time, I have my phone screaming for attention. I have Netflix. I have everything screaming for attention every 5 minutes. Is that part of that hijacking?
It is part of the hijacking. There's something interesting in that as well. Like craving is sort of a funny energy within the body. Like sometimes we might, you get this with people in recovery from alcohol. They could be just thirsty, but they think they're craving a drink. And there's a network within the brain. I know we're going to be talking about connection, but there's a neural network in the brain. It's in the midbrain. It's in an area called the raphe nucleus, for anyone that's interested in the specific science of it. And basically, they've sort of identified this as the loneliness center of the brain. So when you think of the brain, there's lots of these sort of homeostatic sort of processes, like we're satiated, we're hungry. We need to find balance to be satiated, but we're not hungry anymore. So we find the balance, we're in homeostasis. And what they've recognized, what they've identified within the brain is this social homeostasis, and it's within this area of the brain. So if you haven't got enough social connection in your life, you're feeling isolated, your brain will actually crave that social connection. But what you'll find is that people that are isolated and haven't got that social connection, they'll replace that, whether it's food, whether it's drugs, because they can't identify what that craving is. They just need to meet people, talk to people, to connect with other human beings. But the craving is hard to identify. So in terms of craving, in terms of addictions, it doesn't really matter. Addiction is addiction. The same biological processes are at play. There's not an alcohol center and a heroin center. There's one center for all of these things. And we can get mixed up. It's very hard for us to identify and put labels on these things because craving's craving, addiction is addiction.
So that's really interesting because I always wondered, and a lot of the people, again, that I know coming out of in recovery, they're replacing that addiction with something else. It tends to be wonderful stuff like running, rocking, that mad stuff you're now doing. Rocking, who came up with that anyway? God, would you just do normal things? Don't ring me, by the way, I'll ring you for the next hike. In rocking. But dude, that's one thing. The fitness is a big thing, right? So what you're saying, it just attacks the same part of the brain. We just need that craving, wherever it comes from.
Yeah, and I think what's important, there's a lovely theory out there. It's called the natural reward hypothesis. And what we need to do, like addiction is really unnatural rewards. Like alcohol, it's fabricated. It's something that we've created. But these sort of rewards, whether it's phones, TV, these other addictions that we have, we've sort of lost touch with sort of natural rewards. So if you're talking about mindfulness or walks in nature, that's sort of to break the hijacking, the reward hijacking of that system. And it's no surprise to me that there's a spiritual element of recovery, like we're around Buddhism, around 12-step recovery and stuff like that. There's this real spiritual, back-to-earth kind of element to it. And it's sort of like trying to focus on natural rewards, like human connection, like going for a walk in nature, like sort of going for a run, whatever that is. So it's tapping into those natural rewards can really be a breaking point for these hijacked neural systems.
I just want to point out, in case you think I've been disrespectful having a pint when Brian is talking about drinking, but I know you don't have a problem with the drinking.
No,
and we're okay. No. That's why. So any judgment, keep it to yourself. It's my show, I do what I like. It's non-alcoholic, by the way. And that's a lie. So, but okay, so that's interesting. So we're talking about connections, and I think what Gabor Mate has said, connections is the opposite of addiction. And then Joanna Harry took that wonderful book he wrote about connections. And I'm a great believer, and I said the reason why I sit with people like you and the other 180 people I sat with is because I believe in connection. I believe I learn something every time I sit with somebody. And I know what it does for me. But what does it actually do to our brain?
So the connection piece is really interesting. There was a lovely animal study done there recently that they couldn't figure out what was going on. So they were trying to look at the impact of dopamine activity in animal studies to figure out how addiction worked in the human brain. They work on animal studies first. So they were basically taking these rats out of a box and giving them cocaine. But what they noticed was that there was no difference between, very little difference between the rats that they were giving cocaine to and the rats that were left in the box. They were still getting the same dopamine activity. And what they realized over time was that it was a very stupid experiment because they were taking the rats out of a group, putting them in social isolation and giving them cocaine. So it wasn't so much a cocaine experiment as a social isolation experiment. So the rats that were left in the box were getting their dopamine here from the connection with the other rats in the box. So the reality is that we get our dopamine hits, we get our serotonin, another really important neurotransmitter in the brain from our connection with other people. And back to that loneliness center that I was talking about in that other area of the brain. So that raphe nuclei area of the brain, that's usually to do with gratitude and serotonin and the feeling of fulfillment and feeling good. But there is this area of that brain called, that's the center of the loneliness center that the latest research is looking at. And what it finds is, again, that dopamine is not so much about pleasure. Dopamine is about motivation and putting you into action. And what it finds is that when you are socially isolated, it reduces the amount of dopamine in that area, so you go seeking that human connection, which is really, really interesting. But in terms of other factors within the brain, like I haven't even mentioned oxytocin, but there's other elements as well. There's this neuropeptide in the brain. There's lots of great research around this. This neuropeptide in the brain called tachykinin, and this is the latest research as well. And what they find is that people that are socially isolated, they've done this on flies and rats and other animal studies as well, but they've also done it in humans. And when you socially isolate people and they're on their own, animals or people, they become anxious, they become aggressive, they become paranoia, they become stressed, which paradoxically are behaviors that will make them more socially isolated. But it's something that we find is this buildup of tachykinin. And it's no surprise, like if you think of like some of the biggest misfits in the world who have gone on the rampage killing loads of people, they were socially isolated individuals. So they're getting paranoid, they're getting stressed, they're getting aggressive. So we are created, we are molded for human connection. We are social and emotional beings. We need that human connection. And when we don't get it, there's a buildup of tachykinin. There's a buildup of a reduced amount of dopamine in that area of the brain that's pushing us out to get that human connection. But in terms of oxytocin as well, like that seems to get a lot of the headlines. That's more of a hormone rather than a neurotransmitter. But oxytocin is a really interesting kind of hormone as well, because most people believe it's to do with when babies are born and there's the oxytocin release from skin contact, and all of that is true. But it scales depending on the relationship. So even if you pick up another baby, there will be an oxytocin release. But if you pick up your own baby, there's a bigger oxytocin release. And if you even sort of hug your loved ones or just see your loved ones or people in your group, there's a release of oxytocin. But it doesn't even have to be about close relationships. Like when you see your people, there is a release of oxytocin. So it's like this thing, we're part of the same group, and it releases oxytocin. It's this social bonding hormone that's released within the body that gives you a sense of fit, a sense of belonging, a sense of connection with other people. So the power of all of these hormones, like you're talking about dopamine, we're talking about serotonin, we're talking about oxytocin, powerful, powerful hormones that have huge impacts in multiple areas of the body that give you a feeling of happiness, a sense of joy, a feeling of safety. Like I think that's the biggest thing we didn't touch on today. Like I think for me, I didn't have a sense of safety within my body. But if you think of your connection with other people and your connection with loved ones, what do they give you? A sense of safety. Like you have your tribe, you feel safe, you feel secure. So what does that also give you? A lack of fear. So there's no need to go and escape the pain because you feel safe, you feel satiated, you have connection with other people. So in a way, it really is like the opposite of addiction.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're talking about the basic needs that we all have, but there's an interesting study. You're talking about social connections, and the reason why I called it the podcast Social Fabric is because at the time I was worried about the social media and the impact it was having on my two wonderful children that are now no longer teenagers, a little bit older. But the study's been done now. You're talking about holding your own baby. Apparently, the latest studies are showing that we all know that feeding your own baby is the best thing you can do. Mm. However, apparently now we feed our own baby, but we also look at TikTok. And that connection is seen to be breaking up.
Yeah, I was very disappointed to hear recent research that there is an element of connection within social media, because I'd be very anti, even though I'm on social media, I was hoping, like for me, it's all about connection, face-to-face connection, touch connection. Like I think that's what's really important. And social media sort of is breaking the mold of that. And I think the kids growing up today aren't experiencing that real connection. But there is recent research that's sort of saying that there is some element of connection within social media. And I'm sort of glad to hear that as well, because we're not going to break the mold of social media. The kids today are going to be grown up with social media. Like we were at a table with my partner's family, and the two twins, our nieces, were at the end of the table with our two friends. And we looked down at one stage and they were all on their phones. We says, "You're probably texting each other." It was a little joke. And they all looked up, started laughing, says, "We are." Like, they were literally at the table together, texting each other, like, at the table. It was a bizarre thing to see. And I do worry about young people in terms of that connection. And I think they're losing the ability to communicate as well. Because, like, if you're sort of tend to be a little bit introverted or a little bit anxious around other people, you can use your phone as a coping mechanism. All of a sudden, you're not even going to learn the skills. So there's a principle in the Bible, of all things, that I heard one time. It's called the Matthew effect. And it basically talks about, I don't go reading the Bible around like that. It's the only probably thing I've read out of the Bible. And that's not a Bible reader or anything like that. But it's this idea of that it's like the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. But I've noticed this in every element of life. Like if you are someone that struggles socially, you're going to hide yourself socially and you're going to nearly get worse on that. It's a vicious circle. Whereas if you're a bit more extroverted and you go out into the world, you will start being with people more and connecting with people more, and that compounding effect will make the more social get more social and the people that are isolated be more isolated. And I find this in every area of life. So I think with young people as well, especially, they're just not getting that connection and they're not learning the skills to communicate and to navigate the world. And it's going to be tricky territory. I don't know how it's going to go. I really couldn't predict it.
But you're on the board of a couple of, you're on an advisory board of a couple of mental health programs, and also you do a lot of public speaking. I still smile at the fact that I remember exactly what you got paid, and I won't share that with you, on your first gig. And I was like, fair play to you. And I'm sure you're now earning a lot more. And he's available for booking, by the way, if you have money. But no, you do a huge amount of speaking events, which are not just your story. You know, you're talking to, you're going to companies, corporations, all sorts of banks, you name it. What do you see when you talk about the neuroscience of addiction? What do you see in the corporate world? And I say corporate, it doesn't have to be the big organization. You talk to all sorts of organizations. What do you see out there at the moment in terms of addiction?
Wow. Well, there's recent research only in 2022 in Ireland, and it's basically showed that addiction in the workplace has doubled in 2022 as a result of mental health challenges. Tripled for men, actually, but doubled overall across both genders. But it's all as an effect of mental health challenges. So, and again, a lot of people think that addiction is something that we know someone who is in addiction, but 70% of people in deep addiction are still in the workplace. Like, we're phenomenal at masking the challenges that we're facing. So the addiction in the workplace is rife. And I would usually do a lot of talks around different things like managing stress, managing their emotions, giving people a framework and a pathway to navigate life challenges and stuff like that. I have lots of different sort of keynotes that I do, but it's only recently, and it's quite surprising that it's only recently that I've been asked to do a lot of keynotes around addiction. And I think as a result of COVID, and again, disconnection, the hybrid working environment as well, like, people hate me saying this because I'd be very much pro people. I'm certainly not pro corporate, and I would have been very much, if people want to work from home, let them work from home. But I've realized over time, I don't know how good this is for people, like, because we co-regulate each other. We create a culture when we're together in the workplace. So if some people are working from home, it's not going to be good for them. It's not good for the companies where they work. And I'm not talking about the dollar. I'm talking about the culture and the environment where they work, where people can be happy together. Because I worked in an office for years, and even though I was in the depths of addiction, I had a family there. They were like a second family. We were really close, and that was an important part of my life. But with people working from home behind a screen, I also think it's the perfect foil for creating bad habits. So I don't know how it's going to transpire over time. Like, I don't think you're going to get people back into the office. It's never going to be the same as that again. But I think we need to be careful. Like, I think we need to make more of an effort to get into the workplace to be just connecting with other human beings, because there's definitely a massive rise in addiction, and it has coincided with the disconnection and the challenges that people have faced as a result of COVID and the mental health challenges that go with it.
You said a couple of things really fast there in terms of 70% of people with addiction still in the workplace, and men three times more affected more than women.
Addiction for men in 2022 has gone from 7 to 22%. The research with Leia Healthcare, yeah.
Do we know why?
Mental health challenges, mostly anxiety, seems to be the biggest driver. So it's like the amount of suicide you hear these days. Like, I just think, I think it's a combination of COVID. It's a combination. Something has shifted. COVID has done a lot of funny things. Like, COVID is pretty much gone, I suppose, now, but it was a seismic shift. And I'm noticing that people are busier than they've ever been. And I think that's a result of the hybrid working environment as well. But people just are so on the go. Nobody has time for anything anymore. So I think, again, going back to those natural rewards, like I'm delighted that I work in this arena, because what I make 100% the priority. Like, I have a value system that I operate my life from, and my three core values are my energy, my health, and my relationships. But health has got to be number one, because without your health, you're not going to be have good relationships with people. You might have relationships, but you'll be stressed, you'll be angry, there'll be fights. You've got to look after your mental and emotional and physical health first. And I think people haven't really got time for that anymore. People are too busy. Like, you look at kids, they're going to different things every evening, the school runs, their activities in the afternoons, they're working. People in marriages, they if they have kids, they're not having time to themselves. And I just think we're just in this rat race at the moment, and COVID has exasperated that in a phenomenal way. And I don't know how you fix that, but I think people need to take a step back.
And I don't know, I know you don't have the solution to this, but knowing what we talked about earlier on, that you were talking about your addiction was tolerated because people thought you were an alcoholic. What you see now, what would be the one addiction you would wipe out?
Alcohol. Yeah, okay. By a million miles. It's if alcohol became a drug right now, an invented drug right now, I think the FDA would give you a thimble a month or something like that, some crazy amount like that. But it's such a huge financial power. Like, the alcohol industry is absolutely massive. And I don't think, like, if you think of domestic abuse, you think of people just destroying their bodies, you think of the impact it has on kids, looking at their family drinking and stuff like that, you see it everywhere. Like, it's everyone is touched by alcohol in some way. So alcohol would 100% be the number one thing that I think people will have to that I would personally eliminate, because just by the sheer volume of problems that it brings. I can't remember, but when I was doing my PhD research, I looked at all the statistics, and when you look at the amount of healthcare, the amount of money it costs the healthcare system, alcohol would trump all of the other drugs combined 10 times over, 100 times over probably.
Yeah, and going back to the fact that we both love football, who do you support, by the way?
Liverpool. On a winner at the moment, yeah.
That's the third disappointment. You don't read the Bible. You didn't listen to my podcast, and you're now a Liverpool fan.
Liverpool Spur.
I tell you, you're not a 1 year age. But seriously, like, I love football, and I would have called a fan, but I'm an Everton fan, which is wonderful. Like, I'm going there on Saturday.
Oh, but the derby.
But I'm going there on Saturday. I'm going to see the match, and. And it's going to be, I was going to be bombarded by alcohol and sporting advertising, like, everywhere I'm going to look at. The betting thing is horrendous. What do you think of that?
Do you know what? Like everything in moderation, I do say. Like, I wouldn't be saying, like, you ban alcohol. I'm not into prohibition or anything like that. It's okay to have a couple of drinks, like, for most people. Even to put on a bet for most people is okay. And, like, I remember reaching out to, of all people, it's actually an interesting story. Part of my journey was sort of reaching out to people that were quite successful, and it worked out great for me. I just, like, guessed senior leaders, their emails based on where they worked. It was like a thing I'd done off the bat. And one of the people I reached out to was John Boyle. He was the CEO of Boyle Sports. He owns Boyle Sports, like a billion-dollar company, I think, billion-euro company. And when I met John for a meeting, I was sort of getting advice to help me to navigate my business and work with young people as well. Actually, I was looking for tools and tactics for how they became successful in their life. And he actually asked me, he said, what's your birthday? And I said, the 6th of April. And he says, what's your real birthday? And I knew what he was talking about intuitively. And I says, the 8th of October. And he says, mine's the 23rd of September. So he was 23 years free of alcohol. Oh. He was in recovery. And he told me he based his whole model of his business model for gambling industry on the 12-step program. Keep it simple and a couple of elements within that. And I found that quite interesting because he said it to me. He says, like, a lot of people would think it's a bit strange. I'm in recovery from alcohol and I set up this big gambling business. But he says, look, publicans don't ask alcoholics to come into the pub and I don't ask people with gambling addictions to gamble. Now, there's an ethical things that I'm a bit fuzzy with there. Like, I wouldn't totally agree with what he says. But I do think that some people are prone to addictive tendencies and they will find their drug of choice or the behavior of choice somewhere. So I wouldn't be all about banning all of the things that some people find pleasure in, but we just have to, I suppose, find more answers to why some people are so susceptible to these temptations. And that's really where we have to go. So gambling is rootless because there's something about it that it does something to your psychology that is very, very different. It's very different. You're not ingesting something. You're not even doing, you're doing something, but it's not even about winning the money. There's something about chasing this fabricated high. And I've met many people in deep gambling, with deep gambling addictions, and they're probably the more, like, I think many people in addiction have a delusional nature, or the addiction made them a bit delusional. I was a black belt in self-deception personally. But people in with gambling addictions, they take it to the next level. So I don't think we really know what's going on. It's very psychological, but it's very problematic. It really is. And you could lose everything on one bet. You know, that way it's... alcohol is like drink by drink, drug by drug, but gambling is just a funny thing. You can throw it all away in an instant, you know?
Yeah, it's a wonderful documentary by Paul Merson, a wonderful footballer, and he's still addicted to gambling, although he managed to get off cocaine and everything else. And alcohol, well worth watching. Anyway, we won't solve that, unfortunately, but it is a little bit, when I look at that cartoon and I think of I could be gambling here while we're chatting, you know, it's that easy. I could just press the button every few minutes and lose money. So that's what worries me. By the way, we will give you a chance to ask a question. I know you're dying to ask a question. And it is a question. I don't want to know your story. You know who you are. No, genuinely, if you have a question, do ask a question. If you need to share your story, it's okay, but we won't be here all night. So I'll give you a chance in a minute. But just to stay with the brain, you talked about the brain earlier on and how your brain was canned. I remember talking to Brezzy, he had his brains canned before and after meditation, and there was two different brains, which is fascinating, and the neuroplasticity of it all. What else do we know, and where is this going? You know, what I know it's fascinating, the neuroscience is fascinating, what we can see, what's happening in the world of neuroscience at the moment that it's exciting, and with what can we do in terms of addiction to learn more from it?
Yeah, I think one thing to realize with neuroscience is, like, they've learned a lot, but there's so much we don't understand. Like, if you think of neuroscience as climbing Mount Everest, they probably climbed 4 or 5 steps. That's the reality of it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's 100 billion neurons in the brain that have thousands of connections to other neurons. The numbers, the potential combinations are just unthinkable. We can't even get our heads around that, to be quite honest. So there's so much we don't know. And the fact that they think AI is going to be able to replicate what the brain does, they're thousands of years away from that. It's not even close. Like, the reality of us understanding the brain, we're just so far away from it. So it's really important to recognize that. But there has been huge strides made. I think a really important component of it is, like, this idea of neuroplasticity, that we can change our brain. So as I said, I had that scan of my brain in 2013, and I had another scan of my brain in 2018. I mean, just seeing huge changes in my brain over those 5 years. And I actually reduced, you can have this predicted age score based on the density matter of your brain. And I actually reduced the age of my brain by 6 years. So that's through good habits and good living and stuff like that. So it's incredible to recognize that you can change your brain. You can change it from the inside out. When you change your brain, you change how you feel, you change how you think, and then you change the outside behaviors as well. So I think the field of neuroscience, it's brilliant, it's exciting, but we need to temper where we're at with it because there's just so much that we don't know. But I think there's multiple studies we're exploring different things. I think one of the biggest challenges we have is that a lot of the research we know, and I've mentioned it a few times tonight, is these animal studies. And we're doing a lot of research on animal studies. But what they're finding again and again is that the animals just don't translate to humans. the studies just don't translate to humans. We're so much more complex, and even though certain areas of the brain look the same as animals to humans, the impact, when they do these studies and they try to bring it to real world studies, it just doesn't translate like that as well. So there's a lot of struggles from a scientific perspective there, but there's a lot of incredible research going on. But I do think there's some great, some of the latest cutting edge studies that they're doing as well is looking at this idea of neural feedback. So I'd say what Brezzi was looking at was sort of looking at the brain not meditating versus meditating. But what you can actually do as well is you can start to look at the activity within your brain, and you can start to get this on a screen. So I could be looking at the activity in my brain on the screen, and by getting that feedback of looking at that, I can actually calm my brain down by looking at that. So I think that's the next level of where we're going, and we're sort of gamifying that as well. Like, you can sort of put something on the screen, say, lift the ball up into the air. But what you do to lift the ball up into the air is you have to lower the electrical frequency within the brain, which will be a result of a more calmer brain. So when you see the ball going up into the air, you're getting calmer, and you can sort of use that technology then to sort of reduce the activity and the anxiety or the sort of overthinking within your brain by looking at the ball. So this neural feedback is a really cool area where they're doing research as well. But there's lots of cool stuff going on. But we just need to temper it with the complexities of what we don't know as well.
What's the role of AI in all of this?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't dug too deep into AI. I think AI, again, it's machine learning. Like, it's that's what it is. It's a black box, and I think that's the scary part. And a lot of the imaging studies on the brain, they are machine learning studies as well. They are using AI for a long time, but like, there's an input and there's an output, and we don't really know what's going on in the middle. So when you look at AI in terms of, like, there's a lot of work where they're trying to create, like, I know Elon Musk is trying to create this neural link, and it's using AI technology as well, and it's trying to be able to speak to the brain and to get, like, they're talking about putting links within your arms and stuff like that as well, and links within your brain where you can actually talk to other people by just having a link within your brain, sort of like a telepathic sort of way. Now, they're miles away from that, but again, they're sort of tapping into that neural feedback technology as well. So AI has sort of brought it to a whole level where I said we've climbed 4 or 5 steps. AI, with the ability it has to learn in a compounding way, and it's just going to iterate and iterate and iterate, maybe it'll make a leap up of a few thousand feet really, really quick, but I just don't think we know where that's going to go. If you look at the research, they're saying, calm down, it's not going to make huge strides, but then there's other people out there from the AI side as well saying that incredible things are going to happen. So I think it's just watch this space, but it's a little bit scary, to be quite honest. I don't know where it's going to go.
You're talking about looking at the research. Half of this room, especially this group here, won't be never looking at research. So when we're talking about habits and how, especially this group here, they just never, ever, trust me. But you've talked about, you know, making sure that you're rebuilding your brain, your neuroplasticity, and all the habitual things you put into your life. What is, you know, you say looking after yourself. Tell us a bit, what's a day in the life of Brian Penny? Dr. Brian Penny.
So for me, it's about consistency.
Yeah.
And this is what it's about. And I said it already, like, our brains do not want us to be happy. Our brains only care about self-preservation. And our brains, like, the one thing that's really, really important, if you think of biology, like, our biology and our brains love consistency. Like, if you think of animals out in the wild, like, let's say a lion over in Africa, it doesn't have a lion on a Saturday. It's just not what it does. It's not aware. Like, Saturdays and Sundays are human constructs, you know? So consistency is absolutely key. And my partner Natalie is often saying, she actually says, she's so annoyed that I can go to sleep so quick. She thinks there's something wrong with me. She says, something wrong with you, you can go to sleep that quick. But it's because it's consistent behavior. I get up at the same time every day, even at weekends. And basically what I'm doing is, there's an area of the brain called the pituitary gland that releases cortisol to wake you up. And there's an area of the brain called the pineal gland that releases melatonin to put you to sleep. So if you, that's a circadian rhythm that we have, and if you do the same thing all of the time, the brain knows what's going on, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is easy, I'm just going to do what we always do. But if you wake up at 11 o'clock some weekends, or you're up till 3 o'clock looking at TikTok or whatever like that some days, it throws the brain into chaos and it doesn't know what's going on. So consistency is really, really key. That is so, so important, whether it's with sleep, whether it's with all habits. But in terms of my, in terms of what my day looks like, I have a morning routine that I do every single morning. It's a 3-minute morning routine. It's a minute of breath work, a minute of affirmations, and a minute of gratitude. And the reason why I do this, these are really tapping into neuroscientific processes as well. Like, I used to do a lot of mindfulness, but I found that breath work just works better for me personally. And the research shows that it outperforms mindfulness when it comes to stress and anxiety. But the breath work really taps into the heart rate. It can reduce the heart rate in real time by tapping into neural processes as well. So I'm really just priming myself. A morning routine is great. Like, if you win the morning, you win the day. That's a mantra I always keep in mind. And I'm really priming myself to be more present during the day. I'm reminding myself that I have this breath work technique, this tool, that if I feel anxious, I can just bring the body back into homeostasis. For an affirmation, I just affirm what I want to do or where I'm going to be. My latest affirmation is, I'm Brian, I'm strong, I can cope with anything. I can't cope with anything. That's the reality of it. If a bus comes down the road and it smacks me, I'm going to get smacked by a bus. But just telling myself that belief system, I can cope with anything, it just puts you into a much stronger framework for the day ahead. And then a minute of gratitude would be like, gratitude lists are great. They work to a certain extent. But if you really want to get the biggest bang for your buck, like, gratitude practice is not woo-woo. There's some deep, brilliant science, neuroscience grounded in gratitude. And I mentioned it earlier, like, it taps into that area of the brain called the raphe nucleus, which releases serotonin. And if you go deep on a gratitude practice, the deeper you go, the more serotonin you are actually going to release. And it's not about just saying, I'm grateful for my house, I'm grateful for my job. There's a little bit of a bang for your buck off that. But if you really think of people in your life, back to connection, loved ones, and good experiences you had with people. I was over skiing with my two brothers at the weekend. We had an incredible time over there. But I'd often think of the kids in my life, my nephews, and I think of the hugging those kids, spending time with those kids. And I have little visualizations around this. And after that 3-minute routine, every single morning, I do it consistently and religiously. I just feel like I'm smiling from the inside out. And I am. I'm filling my body full of serotonin, full of dopamine, full of oxytocin. It's a neurobiological process. It takes 3 minutes. And it's one of the reasons why I put a lot of my happiness down. It's just setting the tone for the day. It's a really powerful, powerful way to start the day.
I love that. 3 minutes. I don't think anybody cannot, you know, we can all afford 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. And your affirmation, your gratitude, they change regularly enough? You just, every now and then, you feel the right time to change it? Or how does it work?
Yeah, we love, as humans, we love novelty. This is the reality of it. I used to have a more technical morning routine. But I think just change it up, you know, just change it up. We love novelty. Like, sometimes I'd have a different affirmation, and affirmations are really powerful. Like, the words we speak become the house we live in. Like, that is one of my favorite quotes by a Persian poet called Hafiz. Like, if you tell yourself you're a piece of crap every day, you're gonna feel like a piece of crap. That's just the reality of it. And I was really interested in the science of language and emotion because of my own shift in perspective. I realized that my mind was quiet and I felt amazing. So I want to explore the relationship between language and emotion. And I was very interested in my own experience at first. And my own research sort of looked into that. And it's come to me that just how you speak to yourself has a huge impact on your life. So the affirmations for me, like the one I use at the moment, it's just, I'm Brian, I'm strong, I can cope with anything. But I could change that up for whatever it's going to be. It just depends on how I feel on the day.
Lovely. This is my last question now, and then we'll pass it over to the audience. So who's going to play you in the movie, Bonus Time? Don't tell me Colin Farrell, because he's playing everybody. No, but genuinely, what? Tom Cruise. Wow. What's next? Apart from all the wonderful work you're doing, what's the big thing you're hoping to do?
The next big thing I'm doing at the moment, I was over in Oberstown Detention Center for young kids. I'd done a couple of talks there in September, and something really resonated with the group that was there. They just were super engaged in a way that they hadn't been, I was told they hadn't been before. So I want to do a lot more work with them. So I'm actually prepping for the end of March to go over to do a week-long program with the kids and bringing in loads of expert speakers and all. Nice. I'm really, really excited about that. That's the next big thing on the horizon. So wow. Hopefully make it like hard. Kids that have been through a lot of trauma, a lot of challenges, But if you can just, we're not going over thinking we're going to change them in any way. We're just going to try to sprinkle seeds of hope for the future. That's all we're trying to do.
Well, fair play to you. Well done. So anybody wants to ask a question? In the meantime, that's me. And I wrote the thing very small, but I'll be doing two more shows in the next couple of months. The Happy Pair, 20 years in business. Please come along. That's in the Lofted Lounge in town. Sorry, Brian. And we'll be back here with the art of storytelling, because this is exactly what you're talking about. We are different from other animals. We need to talk. We need to explain ourselves. We don't just act. So the art of storytelling, I'll have some wonderful, even more wonderful guests on stage with me. I'll tell you later on, but just go and book the tickets. Thanks very much. Do it now before we give you the word. Who would like to? There's a man there in the back. There you go. That was quick.
That was coming out of nowhere. I'm just reminded by the was that movie Sully at the end of the movie The Hearing, and it's like, this is the first time we've interviewed somebody from a plane crash and the pilot's still here and we can talk to him. It feels like you've been on a massive journey and we get to hear about it. It's brilliant. I'm just curious about something you said earlier about the boss who contacted you afterwards, and he said, you know, maybe I should have pushed on having you fired at the time, and you talked about that journey at the time. Is hitting rock bottom an essential part of the journey, or is there another route to the recovery that you've reached? Because we hear so many stories that talk about that rock bottom moment, but like for those of us who encounter somebody with addiction, do we almost need to be kind of encouraging the rock bottom moment for them to get to a point where they can move again? Or what's your experience with that? Sorry, but long question, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's a really important question as well. What I would say is, like, rock bottom isn't what gets people clean. Rock bottom can be a way of waking people up. It can give you, what we're looking for is awareness. And we've touched on it many times today, like it was Johan Hari and Gabor Mate, like the sobriety is not the opposite of addiction, connection is. I'd probably go one further and say awareness is the opposite of addiction. Like, once you become aware, and I don't mean knowledge, like, most people in addiction, alcohol or drugs, they have the knowledge. They know it's not good for them. But there's a level of awareness that all of a sudden you just see the truth of your ways. So I think rock bottom can be a process that can give you awareness, a sort that can kick you so hard. It's like life saying, you need to listen, and it kicks you hard. And that rock bottom moment sort of wakes you up. So I think it can be a way to wake people up in terms of getting them to change their ways. Like, I think awareness is the catalyst for change. But there's multiple ways of doing it. Like, again, you see so many people in recovery and really good recovery, and they've done it in multiple different ways. But I think a level of awareness is absolutely crucial. And awareness is a funny one. Like, you could be aware, you could be doing a yoga class and you're aware of your body and your what's going on in your mind, but how aware are you when stress comes? And life will give you stress, like the inevitable challenges of life will come. So how are you gonna cope? What's your level of awareness when those challenges come? So what I would say is, I don't think, to answer your question specifically, I don't think you need rock bottom, but you need to find some level of awareness where you can actually see what's going on. You can see what your triggers are, what is actually driving you. And I think that's the opportunity for change. So awareness is what you need, but rock bottom is just one of the ways of giving you that awareness, I think. Thanks.
Thank you. I can't see, but somebody else, yeah, there's Paul. Oh, there's somebody. Oh, Galen. Go ahead, Galen.
Hiya, how's it going? I just wanted to ask, do you drink? Do you smoke? Do you do anything now? And if you don't, are there moments where you're very tempted to do that? And if you are tempted at that time, what is it that you say to yourself to stop yourself from doing that?
So it's interesting. I tend not to say this in public because I don't want somebody that's in recovery from alcohol that is on the edge and wants to have a drink and hears me saying, oh, he can have a drink, so I can have a drink. But I think one of the reasons, like, I've never gotten drunk. I've never gotten drunk since I've been the 10 years in recovery. And I didn't have a drink for, I think it was about 4 years. I don't know if you've seen that scene from Father Ted, where it's Henry Sellers, that's what it is. And Mrs. Doyle's like, go on. I just have one. And he was in recovery and he had one, and all of a sudden all hell broke loose. So I remember, like I had a heroin addiction, but I was just addicted, full stop. I think addiction is addiction. But I had a glass of wine, I think it was about 6 years ago or whatever it was, and it just didn't have an impact on me in any way. But I think one of the reasons why I can have a drink is because I don't want to have a drink. And that's the paradox that's in that. Like, if I wanted to have a drink, then there would probably be a danger behind that, because what would it be wanting to have a drink for? And again, it comes back to I have a very defined core set of values. And my three core values are my energy, my health, and my relationships. And having even one glass of wine, like, I can have the odd glass of wine if I want it, but I don't want it because it doesn't be good for me energy. I don't feel healthier. Even one glass of wine can have an impact on how I feel the next day. It's barely there, but I do notice it. I'm all into measuring my behavior. I have a Whoop app, and if I have one glass of wine, I can see a difference in my heart rate variability, and it has an impact. That's just one glass. So to answer the question, I do have a drink, but I don't really want to have a drink, so I wouldn't consider myself a drinker, but I'm obviously not going to try heroin anytime soon or anything like that, but I've no craving or no want. And I think my personal addiction was all about escaping the pain, but I don't have anything to run away from anymore, so it's like, why would I want to go there? So I think that's the question. I've never had a need to really have a conversation with myself around that, thankfully, but I know that's not the same for lots of people, and I think that's one of the things I feel so grateful for. Like, my book is called Bonus Time, but it could be just called Unbelievably Grateful, because whatever the hell happened, it was the perfect storm for me just to live a happy life, and I found the things that I love, the job I do. I wake up in the morning and I'm dying to get to work, and that's me fuel. That's me drug, to be quite honest. Life is me drug now today.
I'm laughing, thinking the energy, one of your top values. I didn't know who this Brian Penny was. A mutual friend of ours, Fiona Brenn, I said, you got to talk to this guy. So I said, I shall meet you in the radio station. And I said, I better go half an hour earlier so that I can figure out who this fella is. And I sat there in the reception, and this fella shows up 45 minutes earlier. And I said, jeez. So I still didn't know what it was. Full of energy. I was like, God, what am I going to ask him now? Who is this fella? So anyway, but that's I get you. Your energy, your bundle of energy. Fantastic. I hope that answered your question, Galen. Kind of. It did, but you're never going to be happy anyway. anyone else apart from Galen? Yeah, there's a question at the back there. Thank you.
Firstly, thank you very much. That was really, really good dialogue. I'm interested why, not so much science, but why do you think men are so much more susceptible to addiction?
I think fundamentally, like, I think it's not speaking about their problems, it's bottling things up and it's going to be released somewhere. Like, I think women, you often hear, like, of women and girls growing up, they just talk more about their problems. They have girls' nights out and they talk about those sort of real things. There's more intimacy within those groups. But with lads, like, I think it is changing these days. But I know when we were growing up, like, we wouldn't share feelings. I wouldn't even admit I had feelings, never mind sharing my feelings. Like, I wouldn't even admit I had anxiety. And it's that sort of gender role that was a feature of the past. And I think that's still there. Like, I do work out on, I often do talks on building sites and stuff like that. And you see that alive and kicking, that sort of masculine sort of bravado kind of a thing. And it's a fear. It's a fear of being vulnerable. It's a fear of sharing truth and being honest about things. And if you bottle stuff up, it's kind of release somewhere. And I think addiction and suicide is much more prevalent than men. I think fundamentally for that simple reason. I also think today as well, I think there's a challenge where I think the lines are blurred with what men don't really know what they're supposed to be, like with the whole toxic masculinity, all of these different things. Like, what is it to be a man these days? So I think there's a lot of confusion around what we have to be these days. And that sort of really is blurred and linked to this idea that we have to talk about our feelings. And I too fundamentally think we need to, all humans need to talk about how you feel to get that kind of a release. Like, a problem halved is a problem shared. It's a cliche, but it's true. There's a release when you talk about problems. So I think it just comes simply from bottling things up and not having an avenue to share their problems.
Thank you. One last question. There's a gentleman here on the right. No, there's a microphone coming for you. There you go.
First of all, thanks very much, Brian and Andrea. Fantastic. I could ask you about 15 questions, so I just have to slow down the heart rate to go for one if I can. Just you talked about connection again and again, and just on the emotional part, like with all this, there was massive emotion, I imagine, as well, like with tears and with your family here tonight. It's very, I just see it as very, very powerful right now with your family here and seeing you just at the height, you know, you're in a fantastic space and hearing your journey, you know. So I'm just thinking about the emotion behind it. You said about that connection and I suppose the heart brain and the gut brain and the heart connected, like because a lot of this is the head stuff. We're talking about the head stuff and the brain here and it's all up here. But to recover from addiction, I imagine as well, has to connect with the emotion, the emotional part in the brain, because you're very authentic. You have a just powerful, authentic presence when you're in the room. Just you're fully yourself. And I think a lot of in today's world, we see a lot of, people wearing masks, which creates disconnection with going back to what Andrea said about social media and the social fabric and all that. So your authenticity is a shining light. Like, that's what I see, you know. So just imagine just the emotional aspect and what your thoughts are on that. It'd just be great to hear as well.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for that. It is something that's really important. It's just being true to yourself, I think, is fundamentally, it just makes life very easy. You can see, there's nothing to hide. There's nothing, you're you. And I think one of the biggest lessons I got in life was, like, be true to your wonderfully weird self. I think we're all a bit wonderfully weird in a way. But you'll attract what you need and repel what you don't. So if you're being you, there's no mask on, you're not playing games. Well, all of a sudden, if people don't like you, they don't like the real you, that's great. At least they know where they stand, and that's a good thing. Whereas if people then connect with you, that's a good thing as well, because they're connecting with the real you. Now, you might get burned on occasions, and people always say, oh, you can't be giving your truth to everybody or be too authentic because you can be taken advantage of. But I'd be willing to get burned for inability to be able to just be me. I'd like to be able to think I can be that in multiple situations. It can be difficult sometimes, but it's interesting what you said about the heart brain connect. And I think there's an element of, like, it's like we know intellectually and cognitively, we know what to say and do in the world we live in. But I think when you look into more like Buddhist practices and the Tao Te Ching, these ancient wisdoms, it's all about what we don't say. Like, language is super important and super powerful, but there's an inner knowing, and whether it's the heart, whether it's the limbic brain, it's that ancient human wisdom that's there, and it's just a feeling, it's just a knowing that we have. And I think our heads just get in the way. And I think we were chatting about it earlier. I don't know, with yourself, Andrea, or Phil, I was chatting to earlier. It's like this idea of people say, I'm going to get out of my head this weekend. It's like, because the head is so loud, like, we want to get out of our heads. We don't even realize we're saying that. We're using drugs to get out of our heads. So I think what we subconsciously crave is that sort of connection with our true selves, with our authentic selves, that sort of gut brain connection that we have. And I think it's more, we need to sort of feel our way into life, like, as I said, the head just gets in the way. So it's like sort of listening to your intuition and your instinct. And if your head is too loud, you're not going to hear them. So it's sort of like all of these practices that we talk about, like, it's like spending time in nature, spending time with loved ones, spending time on your own in stillness and quiet, meditation, breath work, all of these tools, all of these ancient tools that people have been talking about for centuries, they work. But I think they're all talking about the one thing, and it's sort of just getting in touch with your true self. And you're never going to be able to speak to that, because it's not verbal, it's a knowing. So it's a feeling that we have to feel. And I think when you start talking about it, you've lost it. Like, there's a book called The Tao Te Ching. It's an incredible book, the Chinese Book of Wisdom, 2,500 years old. And it often says, like, the Tao that's named is not the Tao, that the Tao is like the way. And it also says, those who say don't know, and those who know don't say. So I obviously don't know, because I'm trying to say it here. But it's really, there's something, you just need to sort of be quiet with yourself and just try to feel that kind of connection that you have. And I just don't think we can verbalize, and like you said, the head gets in the way, words get in the way. Cheers, thank you.
I don't want to interfere with Brian's circadian rhythm, and he have to go to bed now, so I'm going to call it a day. Thanks a million for participating. But I really want to say thank you so much, Brian, for being so open and sharing everything with us. But also want to thank the rest of the Penny family. I'll have you up next time because I want to know the other side of the story. But thanks a million for being here, and thanks a million for all your help.
Thank you.
Sunny days, shining like the sunny days. We never give up, just asking for.